are full right now. We are full. We do not have capacity for more of these unaccompanied children who come across the border. And that what happens is they get backed up there at the Department of Homeland Security's facilities because I can't put someone in a bed that does not exist in our shelters.
Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar, he says his department is about to run out of money to house migrant children. Congressional Democrats in the White House are at odds over how to increase funding. Meanwhile, John Sanders, the acting commissioner of Customs and Border Patrol, is resigning today. Also, 100 kids who were moved from an overcrowded Border Patrol station in Clint, Texas, were moved back because there wasn't room for them in the new place. Caitlin Dickerson is here with the latest. She covers immigration for the New York Times. Hi, Caitlin.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Okay, thanks for being there. All right, so let's talk about these children moved out of the station in Clint, only to be moved back. What happened?
So what Customs and Border Protection officials told us on a call this morning was that they had eliminated overcrowding at the facility. It was over capacity previously. About 249 kids had been transferred into longer-term placements within the shelter network that's operated by the Health and Human Services Department. And that, they said, allowed them to send more than 100 kids back to Clint, where they said now there's sufficient space to house them. But the officials added that no additional resources were being provided beyond those that children had during the time period when lawyers visited the facility and saw a very concerning observations.
Right. And where are the other kids? Where were they moved, the ones who weren't moved back to Clint?
So, you know, it's a little confusing to try to track who exactly is where. So here's what we know. Originally, there were more than 300 kids at the Clint facility. We know that about 249 of them were transferred into the long-term shelter network that HHS operates, and that the others were sent to a temporary tent facility that CBP operates in El Paso. Now, of the remaining others, some of those may have gone back to Clint. Some of them may still be in the tent facility. Obviously, the CBP says that more than 100 kids are back at Clint. So that has to include some kids who were there originally and some kids who weren't there originally but are there now.
Oh, my gosh. It's very confusing. Is there room for this amount of kids at that Clint facility?
So the officials have not given us the official capacity at Clint. All they would say is that it was over capacity when they had 300 kids in their care there. We don't know exactly what the capacity is. They also said that overcrowding there has been eliminated, so you would assume that the 100 or so who are there now fall within the capacity limitations. But as we pointed out, I think the concerns and the limitations are not just around capacity. They're also around resources. And one thing the official said on the phone with reporters this morning was that because the Border Patrol station was built for short-term placements, it does not have showers. So kids who are there still are not going to be able to have showers, and we don't know whether they're going to get access to clean clothes or to sufficient food. Those were some of the concerns that came up with the first set of kids at Clint, and they told lawyers that they weren't giving even soap to wash their hands.
No soap to wash their hands. Well, apparently there has been this outpouring of aid, people trying to bring stuff to this facility. Is that getting in?
So far, it's not getting in. We've been talking to organizers. You know, over the weekend, there was such a strong reaction to the situation at Clint that people began to organize from all over the country. I've heard of people from California, from New York, from Iowa, from Michigan, from Washington, D.C., some of them sending resources, money, or supplies to the facility in Clint, and others getting in the car. And they started to arrive on Sunday, more arriving today. So far, we haven't heard of anything being accepted by the facility in Clint. This morning, Border Patrol officials told us on the phone they were reviewing their policy for accepting donations to see whether they might be able to start accepting things from the outside. But they also said that the facility was not running low on supplies. They said that, you know, diapers, snacks, all these things have not been running low. They disputed the lawyers' accounts. So, you know, again, with reporters not being allowed inside, we're left wondering how to square these two different accounts.
Right. With, again, the lawyers saying there wasn't adequate food, they didn't have clothes, some babies didn't have diapers.
Exactly. So, for example, Ilora Mukherjee, she is a director of an immigrants rights clinic at Columbia Law School. I interviewed her for the story I wrote about Clint. She said that she and her colleagues collectively had interviewed 60 kids there, and that every single one said that they had been hungry, that some said they were waking up in the middle of the night because of hunger pain. And she also said she observed toddlers who were in need of diapers, who had basically been relieving themselves in their dirty clothes that they were wearing because they didn't have diapers on. You square that with Border Patrol officials saying that actually there is no shortage of diapers. That's the situation that we're in now, right? trying to compare those two versions.
Yeah. Okay. And so meanwhile, there has been outrage, national outrage, after all of these stories hit the media. And John Sanders, the acting head of CBP, has announced his resignation today, or an official said that he is resigning next month. Is he a casualty of all of this bad press?
We're still piecing that together. What we know from our sources in that federal agency, U.S. Customs and Border Protection, is that Mr. Sanders had been contemplating leaving the agency for a long time. As you know, there's been a lot of shuffling within people who are running the various agencies that have to do with immigration, and even more news coming out today. The Times is just reporting that the acting head of ICE is now moving over to CBP. We've got a different person coming in to run CBP. So it's not exactly clear whether Mr. Sanders decided to tender his resignation because of the fury over Clint. I think, you know, it's hard to imagine that it was a complete coincidence, given how significant the story was, how significantly it was covered over the weekend. But there's a shuffling happening that is much larger, I think, than Clint, and much larger than just Sanders.
Right, because you have no one confirmed to head CBP or ICE or even the Department of Homeland Security. Everyone's acting at this point.
Everyone's acting. And from what we hear from our sources, you know, the president on any given day will be on the phone speaking directly to people who are running, not just his cabinet secretaries, but even people who are running the lower level agencies, making decisions and influencing who's going to be running what on any given day. It's all changing very quickly. You know, I think what's clear is that there is a charge from the White House, which is to eliminate or significantly decrease the number of people crossing the border, kind of at whatever cost it requires. And I think, you know, the approach to trying to address that request changes every few days. And along with it, so too changes the people who are in charge.
Okay. And very quickly, Congress is scheduled to vote on a bill today, or the House is, and there's been some infighting amongst the Democrats there. Where does that stand? Is there going to be a vote today, and where is it likely to go?
What we know now is that a vote is planned for today, and it's very difficult to tell what the outcome will be. Democrats remain divided over how to proceed. Some feel they don't want to be seen as, you know, the reason why children can't get access to diapers or to sufficient food, because the Border Patrol agency doesn't have the money and Democrats are blocking it. At the same time, many Democrats feel very strongly that they don't want additional funding to be used, for example, in raids against immigrant families like those that had been planned for this Sunday and that were recently postponed for 2 weeks, according to the president on his Twitter feed. They don't want the funds to be used for harsh treatment of asylum seekers, for example, along the border. So their hands politically, from their perspective, are pretty tied right now. But I think what's very clear, resoundingly clear from all of the federal agencies involved, is that if they don't get this money, that some of the issues that we're hearing about, overcrowding, lack of resources, lack of medical care, lack of food, those issues are only going to get worse. So I would imagine, if I had to, that I think at the end of the day, not necessarily specifically today, of course, but at a certain point, the money will be provided, I think, because it's the only way to address some of these very serious health and safety issues.
All right. Caitlin Dickerson, covering immigration for The New York Times. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up, we'll speak with a member of the Hispanic Caucus, Congressman Gil Cisneros, about whether or not he supports this bill, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Congress is set to vote on a bill today that would deliver more than $4 billion in emergency aid to help address that crisis at the border. It's not a sure thing it'll pass. Some Democrats are pushing back. They argue that any new money would just go toward the Trump administration's crackdown on immigrants. Meanwhile, Republicans are siding with President Trump, who is threatening to veto it. The Senate Republicans have their own measure. California Democratic Congressman Gil Cisneros joins us now to talk about all this. His district includes parts of L.A., Orange, and San Bernardino counties. Welcome to the program, Congressman.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, do you support this bill that's in the House?
Well, you know, the bill isn't perfect, but I think in comparison to what the Senate's trying to do, and we're left with the option of doing nothing and letting the funding go away, I think it's the best thing that we can do right now. So I am leaning towards yes.
You're leaning towards yes. And yet there are members of your caucus who are saying no. What are the internal discussions like?
Well, you know, everybody would like to see more added to this bill, right, to really address some of the humanitarian needs that these children and families that they need, especially when it comes to CBP. But, you know, this bill is really about addressing the needs right now with the with Health and Human Services. And really, because the president, fortunately, has created this situation where he's created this crisis, and now we're in a situation where they're going to run out of money. And if they run out of money, they're not going to have diapers for these kids. They're not going to have food for these kids. They're not going to be able to give them the services that they need. And while it may not be perfect, you know, at least for me right now, I think it's the best thing that we can do.
Right. Although some people are saying, some of the more progressive members, so-called progressive members, the left side of your party are saying, look, this, no more money for ICE or CBP, because they're just going to use this money to house and detain, arrest more migrants.
Well, in the appropriations bill, they did put in restrictions as to what the money can be used for, and it doesn't specify that any of the money can be used to round up any individuals from whether it be ICE or CBP. And so I'm putting my faith really in those appropriations, the people who wrote the bill, that's true. And I believe that we're restricting those funds that'll prevent people from going out there and really using it to round up those individuals that, you know, the president said he's going to go after. Nobody wants that, and I think the bill actually prevents them from transferring any of that money to be used for that purpose.
And I guess that's one reason why President Trump says he'll veto it. So is this
basically the president
dead
just
on arrival?
He just wants a blank check to be able to do with whatever he wants, and that's not going to happen. You know, Congress has oversight. Congress has the power of the purse and to spend the money as we see fit and to appropriate it as where we see it needs to be. And we're not going to give that responsibility, just turn it over to the executive branch, turn it over to the president to let him do whatever he wants. There has to be limitations. There have to be restrictions. We want this money to go towards the children to make sure that they're being taken care of. We want it to be making sure it's going towards the families.
How different is this bill from the Senate version?
It restricts money from, you know, the Senate version has more money going to ICE. It has more money going to CBP. Our bill restricts that. Our bill provides more humanitarian aid. And so those are the differences that it makes. It really focuses, I think, more on the families, more on what they need, instead of really what it is that ICE or CBP or what maybe Homeland or Health and Human Services might need.
Right.
Ours is more about the families.
Right. And so do you see any room for compromise? Because it seems at this moment that both sides are pretty much locked into their positions. The Senate Republicans and President Trump want more money for security, for the wall, for that kind of thing. And the House Democrats want more money for humanitarian aid. Is there any room for some compromise?
Well, you know, I hope the administration doesn't double down on this because, you know, these are real people that we're dealing with. These are real lives. These are children. These are our families. We don't want to use them as a bargaining chip, right? We need to make sure that we take care of them. They're in our custody, and we have a responsibility as a government in order to make sure that they're provided for and they have the services that they need. I hope that this administration doesn't try and use them in a way that they think they can break us in order to get what he wants. That's not going to happen. You know, we're standing up for families. We're standing up for people. And this bill is going to give us, you know, the oversight to make sure that that's being done. You know, one of the things that I know a lot of the people from the Progressive Caucus and Democratic Caucus have fought for as a whole that this bill has, it really gives us the ability to go into these facilities so that we can check them out. And we don't have, right now, I believe it's 2 weeks where we have to go there and give them notice before we can go into a facility. This bill will let us be able to go down there on, you know, just at a moment's notice, anytime we want, we can go in there and really see what is going on in these facilities. And that's a plus. And we're not going to give that up.
Right. And the president, meanwhile, is threatening that he will begin this mass deportation maneuver that he postponed. It was supposed to take place over the weekend. And he said, well, I'll wait 2 weeks to allow the Democrats to figure out this spending, this appropriations. And if it's not a plan that he likes, he's going to begin the deportations. What's your response to that?
Well, I don't like what the president's plan is. I think he's going after these individuals who have rights. They have an ability to come here. A lot of the people that he's preventing from coming to the United States are coming here claiming asylum. They have a right to do that, and he's preventing them from doing that. And now he's trying to round them all up and say that they don't belong here. You know, our country has always been about welcoming people in, about welcoming immigrants. This country was built by immigrants, and it's not going to change. And when you look at the data and you look at, you know, how the immigrant community really provides an economic benefit to our country, and that's something that we need to really to focus on and accept that we need these individuals. We need them here. We need their workforce. We need their labor. We need them to come in here and to help us out.
What are you hearing from members of your district, from your constituents about this very issue? How is it affecting them personally?
You know, my district, people want immigration reform. You know, I live in a very diverse district. It's 67% is an immigrant community. It's a minority majority. Immigration is an important issue for them. They want to be able to bring their families, to bring their siblings, their daughters and sons, their grandparents, their fathers and mothers, to be able to reunite them together so that they can be with their families that are here in the United States. They want to be able to do what the First Lady did in sponsoring her parents so they could become U.S. citizens. I've talked to many constituents that said they've been waiting 15, 20 years to bring their son or daughter here to the United States. It shouldn't take that long.
Right.
It's been way too long since we've really gone and redid our immigration. We need to go in there and we need real immigration reform that's going to really address a lot of these issues.
Final question, just a few seconds. You're scheduled to break for a week at the end of the week for the July 4th recess. Do you think Congress should postpone that if there's no deal reached on funding?
Look, we have our job to do, and I know if that's something that we see, if we're going to pass this bill today, and hopefully the Senate will be able to get it done as well, and we can go on our break. But if not, then, you know, maybe we do need to be here in order to kind of make sure that we take care of it.
All right. California Democratic Congressman Gil Cisneros, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, a 4,000-mile journey to the Arctic by canoe and by foot and coming face-to-face with wildlife.
It was apparently healthy, big male black bear that thought it could eat us, and it maybe hadn't seen humans before or just had the sense that we were smaller than it was and was looking for something to eat.
The author of The Sun is a Compass, next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Two people alone for 6 months, traveling 4,000 miles by rowboat, by foot, by skis, rafts, across some of the most remote and forbidding landscape on Earth. A journey few elite adventurers have managed to pull off. But ornithologist Caroline Van Hemert and her husband Pat always dreamed of doing it. They called it their trans-North American dream. It would take them from Bellingham, Washington, up to the Arctic Circle. And in March of 2012, they set off. Caroline Van Hemert has written about this journey in a new book. It's called The Sun is a Compass, a 4,000-mile journey into the Alaskan wilds. And she joins me now from Alaska. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. All right. So you and Pat, you're both outdoors enthusiasts and had spent a lot of time trekking outdoors and just being in nature. And, you know, as I said, you're an ornithologist and you live in Alaska, grew up in Alaska. But this is something entirely different. You basically had no training for this, and the planning for it, which you call a logistical nightmare, took 6 months. And so you had to really understand the terrain as well, which you had never been to, right? I mean, it's where few humans go. How did you figure out how to space out your days and what you would need and what kind of conditions you would face?
Sure. Some of the sections, there was a bit more information about, for example, the Inside Passage. So we took rowboats up that first part from Bellingham to near Haines, Alaska, where I am today. And that part, you know, we had enough information to at least make some rough guesses about how many miles we could do in a day if the conditions permitted. And we also weren't quite as limited in that leg of the journey by weight because we had these rowboats. And so we were actually using the water's buoyancy to help us carry really heavy loads. But there were other sections where weight was critical. We really couldn't carry anything more than we needed. And we were somewhat restricted by the distance of communities. So we were using mostly the Postal Service in both the U.S. and Canada to resupply ourselves. And so we mailed things in many cases months in advance or had my parents ship them out as we went. And so we really needed to get those ones right, because if the food wasn't there when we got there or we didn't calculate correctly, we were going to end up sort of stranded in these very remote locations without good options for resupply. So there was a lot of calculating that went involved, although, you know, at the end of the day, there's only sort of so much we could calculate based on these really big unknowns. So we made our best guesses. And for the most part, it worked out fairly well with a couple of sort of big exceptions.
Yes, which you go into in the book. And I was going to ask you about your bear encounter in a moment, though. First, I want to pick up on what you're talking about in that first leg of the journey when you're rowing in these rowboats that your husband built, right?
He did build them, yeah. And that wasn't the original plan. We were hoping to try to find them and, you know, buy these boats like most people would do. But we had at that point already committed to the idea of rowing, both because we wanted to use our legs and not just be sort of sitting, letting our legs atrophy before we took on the skiing and the hiking and the rest that would require our whole bodies. And also because we knew they'd be more efficient and also more stable in pretty stormy spring conditions. So yeah, Pat ended up building those boats, again, something to kind of squeeze in between all of the other things that we were doing. But the big unknown for those is that we had never rowed before. So fortunately, we did learn fairly quickly how to operate them and how to steer and how to propel ourselves without just going in circles. But the first day would have been pretty laughable for anyone to watch, I'm sure.
Did you think the first day, this is not an auspicious beginning? Like, I don't know how to do this. I'm banging up my knees and my hands and it's really frustrating and I have to row 1,200 miles.
Yeah. Yeah. There were a lot of doubts that day of, you know, just what we had gotten ourselves into. And of course, we were tempted to go back and borrow a double kayak from a friend who had one sitting in his boat shop. But we gave it a little more of a try before giving up so quickly.
I'm wondering, though, there must have been moments during the following 6 months where you encountered a lot of hardship, a lot of tough moments where you thought, I can't go on. I want to give up. I want to turn back.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, interestingly, the probably lowest moment I would say for both of us happened at a time that wasn't the most physically demanding, and that was on the Mackenzie Delta. So up in the Canadian Arctic, the Mackenzie River flows north into the Arctic Ocean. And, you know, on paper, it looks like a logical way to get from where we were, which was the Yukon's interior, up into the Arctic coast, which was a place we wanted to travel to and explore. And we had heard from other people, you know, that the bugs can be bad and the water can be very slow for paddling, especially for these pack rafts, which are these little inflatable boats that we can roll up and put on our backs. And then when we get to water, you blow them up and you go on your merry way. And they work great for so many things, but they don't do well when there's any kind of headwind or in really slow, flat water. And the Mackenzie Delta turned out to be, you know, not only as people had warned us, but so much worse. And we got there and we had, in many cases, a strong headwind. We had current that was actually flowing the opposite direction, in part because the winds off the Arctic coast pushed the water backwards at times. And then the bugs were unlike anything I had ever seen, despite, you know, my many years working in Alaska and traveling in the north. Those were definitely the days and the weeks that felt the most pointless and in turn made us both question what we were doing and, you know, kind of why we were wasting our, I guess, our lives paddling these boats upriver in hordes of mosquitoes. And it all felt rather discouraging. And I think that was when it first crossed my mind that I might quit this thing if I had the chance.
Just describe what the bug situation was like. I think most of us have had encounters with mosquitoes and they're pretty unpleasant. But the description that you have in the book is something entirely different. You say that the Mackenzie Delta reduced you to a reptilian state, that it was just something like it was like biblical, like a plague of insects. You couldn't expose any skin at all, right?
Yeah, biblical is a good way to describe it. For example, you know, you hear stories, and before they always seemed more like stories to me than true anecdotes of caribou calves that are essentially bled to death by being bitten by mosquitoes. And it definitely felt like the kind of situation in which that was completely plausible. And it got to the point where, yeah, the reptilian state came about, I think, because there was just so much sort of input from this unpleasant, really unbearable buzzing and biting and sort of sensation of itching and being driven a bit mad. And it got to the point where, you know, cooking food outside just, it was absolutely not worth our trouble. We would eat rehydrated food that was made with cold water. So, you know, instant coffee that we just added some cold water to, or instant oatmeal that is meant to be cooked, but, you know, put some cold water in it and call it good enough. And stopped cooking any meals. I even got to the point where it made sense to me to pee in my food dish rather than have to go outside and bear myself to the mosquitoes, even just for a couple of moments. So it got quite extreme. And again, like something that I thought I knew what bad bugs look like until I got to the Mackenzie Delta and I realized I had no idea.
How long were you there battling the bugs?
For 2.5 weeks.
2.5 weeks?
It was a long time. God. I mean, the intensity of it happened, you know, over a period probably of more like 5 or 7 days. But yeah, it was a couple solid weeks of pretty intense bugs. Plenty of time to question what we were doing.
Yeah, exactly. I want to get to the bear encounter now. You were in bear country, I guess, towards the end of your trip. And suddenly you realize that there's a black bear very close to you. And it was not a chance encounter. Like, you realize that bear, you didn't just come upon that bear. That bear had been stalking you.
Yeah. And, you know, up to that point, we had seen many, many bears on that trip. And certainly over the years of working up here and living up here, I've seen plenty of bears. But it really shocked me how quickly it became obvious that the bear was predatory, that it had been stalking us. It was just in a split second I turned and I saw it, and I knew, based on where it was relative to me, the fact that it had been so quiet, so many things about that moment that made it, you know, glaringly obvious that it did not have good intentions, and it certainly wasn't frightened of us. And as a result, we changed our behavior and response and tried to be much more aggressive back to it once the bear circled back around and wouldn't leave us alone. So that turned into about a 30-minute standoff with the bear approaching, in some cases, to within a few feet, and us screaming and throwing things at it. And at one point, we sprayed it with bear spray, which is this capsicum pepper spray that's a bear deterrent, as probably some people are familiar with. And it sort of worked. The bear was approaching us so slowly at that point that it could actually see the pepper spray cloud and was able to duck its head and move away from it. And everything was happening in very, very slow motion. You know, wasn't one of those encounters where we're running at each other or, you know, accidentally bumping into each other and then it all happens in a split second. It was very slow and drawn out, and that almost made it more terrifying.
What eventually made it go away, or how did you escape?
I think our persistence was effective, that we, you know, immediately in both of our heads, we knew that we needed to change its perception from it being the aggressor to us being the aggressor. And so we were doing everything we could think of to make ourselves big and seem aggressive. And, you know, we were certainly not in defensive posture, which would have been the right thing to do had the bear been startled or, you know, was defensive of its cub or something like that. It was a apparently healthy, big male black bear that thought it could eat us. And it maybe hadn't seen humans before or just had the sense that we were smaller than it was and was looking for something to eat. So we were just really persistent in being aggressive back. And I think it eventually decided it just wasn't worth the trouble. It probably didn't like that bear spray very much and didn't really like, you know, us throwing things and yelling at it. And then eventually just kind of made wider and wider circles until it wandered off far enough that we felt comfortable. I wouldn't say, well, comfortable is not the right word. We felt like it was worth the chance of trying to walk down to the river and get on the other side of the river and hopefully cover some ground and have it lose our scent. And so we did. And so Pat led the way and I was kind of the bear watch from behind and was keeping my eyes out to see if it was going to follow us or try to surprise us from somewhere else. And that was probably the scariest part of the whole encounter, was when we were trying to get away but not knowing at that point where the bear was and, you know, if it was still following us. And then we were finally able to reach the river, cross the river, and made our way down the other side and fortunately never saw it again.
Is that common that a bear will stalk people?
Extremely uncommon. It's really, really rare. And I had to keep telling myself that, you know, throughout the rest of the trip because we weren't quite done yet. And up to that point, we were feeling fairly comfortable in bear country, you know, with taking the usual precautions. But that definitely shook my confidence a lot. And I had to keep reminding myself that was one bear. It was a rare bear. And chances are I'll never meet one like that again in my lifetime.
So this was a 6-month trip and you really had to plan it out so that you would avoid winter when you got to the Arctic Circle, or the worst part about winter. So when did you arrive at your final destination and what was that like for you?
Yeah, so we ended on September 9th and we did end up finding kind of early winter, which isn't that unusual in the Arctic, but it snowed a lot earlier than we were hoping in the mountains and made it really difficult for us to get over this last kind of set of passes that were going to drop us into the Noatak Valley, which was the drainage that we were going to follow to the Chukchi Sea in the northwestern part of the Arctic. And we finally made our way over and kind of ran into one hurdle after another. So at this point in the trip, we were feeling really strong and really pretty on top of our game. And, you know, like we could take on anything. And then our one and only food drop that came by air, by a bush plane, couldn't make it to us. And so we were stuck without food for several days and just kind of slowly starving in the tent, wondering what was going to happen. And so all of these things kind of set us back as we were getting really close to what we thought was reaching our goal. But then there was also a moment that wasn't quite the end of the trip, but it felt like it could have been, because it was such a culmination of so many things and so many experiences along the way. And that was crossing paths with the Western Arctic caribou herd on their fall migration. And so shortly after we had been waiting and waiting and waiting for this food resupply that did eventually come but left us pretty weakened and almost starving, we were able to continue on our way in a canoe down the Noatak River. And all of a sudden, we looked up and we saw what we thought was a branch floating across the river. And instead, it was a pair of caribou antlers, caribou swimming to the other side of the Noatak. And so we were watching and we saw a few more animals and were really interested. So we pulled over to the side of the river and kind of hiked up onto shore to see if we could see any signs of them coming. And then we heard this sound in the bushes coming from behind. And so we ducked down and pretty soon we were right in the middle of this caribou migration. And there were hundreds and then probably thousands of animals that crossed. And in some cases, they were so close that, you know, we were just sitting there hunkered down, trying not to scare any of them and make any noise. And at one point there was a big bull that stepped over Pat's legs that were outstretched on this little part of, I guess, what turned out to be a caribou trail. and a little calf came and sniffed us just a few inches from our faces. And so it was a really a moving and incredible experience that came, you know, at the end of these hardships, I guess. And it was really powerful, as you can imagine, in part because we had been following the caribou for so long, not necessarily this herd, but we relied on caribou trails to get us across so much of the Arctic. So across the whole Brooks Range, you know, when we would reach difficult parts of the terrain, all we had to do was look at our feet and find the caribou trail, and that was the direction that we knew we needed to go. So they have this, you know, intuitive sense of how to cross the landscape and have these trails that have been worn for many, many generations. And so those were the footsteps that we were following in. And so to get to see them on their own migration, their own journey, was a really incredible way to bring all of those experiences and together into the actual moment of seeing them on their way.
And did that trip change your relationship with your husband? Because it really is stripping everything else away. You only have each other. And then, you know, the elements, it's just got to be incredibly intimate.
Yeah, it is incredibly intimate and on so many different levels. And, you know, I feel really fortunate to have had that experience with the person who, you know, is also my life partner and now I'm a parent with, because there are so many things that I feel like we learned about each other and learned to trust about each other that translate, you know, into the everyday stuff as well.
Well, I want to thank you so much. And congratulations on the book and congratulations on the trip.
Thank you. Thank you so much for chatting. It was really a pleasure.
Caroline Van Hemert, she's the author of The Sun is a Compass, a 4,000-mile journey into the Alaskan wilds. And Steve Chiotakis is here now with a preview of Greater LA coming up in about 15 minutes from now. Hello.
Do you remember where you were 10 years ago on this very day?
Is this the day Michael Jackson
died? It is.
Died?
And Farrah Fawcett. But yes, Michael Jackson.
I remember exactly where I heard it.
Where?
And where I was. I was at the preschool picking up my son.
And you knew it, right? You knew it. And so you had a feel for what happened. Mm-hmm. Obviously, a lot going on. The helicopters that transported his, you know, unresponsive body and all of that stuff.
Yes.
We're talking today about that chaotic day, but we're also talking about in the wake of these new allegations in the Leaving Neverland documentary on HBO, like what we do when we listen to Michael Jackson. Like, can we hear him with a clear conscience? Mm-hmm. It's changed, right? Or has it?
It has.
It has changed. To some people, it's changed. Some people, his ardent fans, no.
Okay.
We'll talk about it.
Coming up.
How about that for a conversation?
Wow.
Huh?
Turn away from that one.
Yeah.
Greater LA at 1 o'clock. Coming up, why Judge Judy is the queen of daytime television and how she appears off the bench. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Tuesday. That means it's time for our regular TV segment we call TV on the Radio.
Clear eyes, full hearts, get loose.
Oh my God! They've killed Kenny!
Three words for you. Treat, yoke, sell.
I am the one who knocks.
That's what she said.
Well, today we're going to talk about the most famous judge in America.
When did you give the plaintiff checks from that bank account?
Like 3 months
Not
ago?
Like. I don't want to hear like. I want you to take like out of the dictionary.
For sure. It was like in August.
It was in August.
Judge Judy has been on the air now for some 2 decades, resolving real-life small claim disputes and correcting grammar. She is the queen of daytime, consistently beating out Ellen, Dr. Phil, even Oprah when she was on. Jasmine Hughes profiled Judge Judy in the New York Times Magazine recently, and she's here now. Hi.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you, and what a treat you got to spend time with her off the bench and see her in her, I guess, her real life, her environment.
Which is the Ritz-Carlton, yeah.
That's where she hangs out?
Yes.
Of course. Yeah, she's pretty wealthy. She makes like, what, $50 million a year or something?
She makes $47 million a year for working 52 days, which are actually 2 days every other week.
Oh, wow. Okay, so that's a
great
gig.
It's like, what are
gig.
We doing with our lives?
I don't know. Clearly, we've made big mistakes. So tell me what it was like being with her off the bench. Is she like she is when we see her on TV?
She's exactly the same. It's really, really remarkable. So one of the things that initially made her famous, Judy was a family court judge in the Bronx and Manhattan in the 80s. And she had garnered such acclaim that 60 Minutes came and they did a segment on her, and like the toughest talking judge in America. And so I watched this clip, which probably came out in the early 90s, a lot when I was doing research for the story. And the difference between her then and her now is very, very small. She's exactly the same as you expect her to be. In person, I would say she's a little bit more of a mensch. She's at her core just like a doting Jewish grandmother who just wants to brag about how great her kids are and how great her grandchildren are, mm-hmm. and make sure that everyone gets their massages by the end of the day. But she is sharp, and she is tough, and she is smart, and she is so, so funny.
Huh. Yeah. And that is her appeal, right? That she comes out with these zingers from the bench.
Absolutely. She has these things called Judyisms, which are sort of like the one-liners, or really just the insults that she likes to throw at people who are in front of her when she's on the show. So I think the one I used in the story is like, you know, even on my worst day, I am still smarter than you on your best day. She has something along the lines of, I want first-time offenders to think of their day in my courtroom as the second worst thing that's ever happened to them, circumcision being the first.
Okay. Well, you start your piece off by talking about her new hairstyle. And I know it's just some superficial thing. It actually is her identity, right? That helmet of hair is gone, and now mm-hmm. she has a ponytail that she clips on. It's not real hair.
No, it's not real. It's funny. I just so I went and I met with her in Los Angeles in February, and she had her hair pulled back, and I asked about it offhandedly, and I didn't know there was going to be such a thing. And then once those episodes debuted, the episodes that she was filming when I was with her debuted in the next month or so, the people in the Facebook group, she's a very, very active Facebook fan base, lost their freaking minds. I say this in the story. At one point, the moderator of one of these Facebook groups had to post a message, and they were like, look, we've had enough of the negativity. Everyone here is a fan of the judge. She should be able to do whatever she wants to do with her hair. If you continue to talk about this, we're just going to delete the post. It was pandemonium.
But the hair was important for her because it meant less time in the makeup chair, less time dealing with that famous
absolutely
coiffure.
I mean, she's 76 years old.
Yeah,
she just, you know, she doesn't want to spend a lot of time like tinkering with her hair in the morning. She, as we already talked about, like makes a pretty decent chunk of change, has a really wonderful life, and I think the way that we talked about it is that, you know, she's just starting to spend more time on the things that are most important to her. She loves dogs, so she wants to spend time with her dogs. She wants to spend time with her grandchildren, with her husband, just time alone in the morning. And this was just one easy way for her to get a little more time to herself every day. And honestly, that ponytail, she told me, only cost $29.95. So I would do it too.
That's a deal. So with that ponytail and the fact that she wears a black robe with a little lace white collar, she really did look like Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She reminded me in the photo in the piece that you had. I said, oh, that could be a younger version of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. But then I thought about how they both approach the law. They're both small Jewish women, both very smart. They have a lot of similarities. But they both approach the law from different perspectives, entirely different perspectives. Judge Judy, very conservative, it seems, and Ruth Bader Ginsburg, famously not. But also, Ruth Bader Ginsburg spending hours and hours and hours constructing her legal opinions and going through the precedent and considering angles and shades of gray, whereas Judge Judy spends, what, 5 minutes?
Mm-hmm.
So does she see herself as a legal scholar, like a legal mind? How does she see her relationship with the law?
What's funny about Judy and RBG is that they actually went to the same high school, several years apart, but they're from the same area of Brooklyn. And so I went into the story thinking a lot about the differences between these two, you know, like foremost female legal minds in America. Judy is very interested in individual dispute. And whenever I tried to talk to her about larger themes, she totally waved me away. She has no interest in systems, like no real interest in root causes of certain things. And it's something that I found very frustrating over our time together, because she really just wants to deal with the two or three people in front of her. She doesn't want to know where you came from or the circumstances of what's going on. That's why she's so quick, and that's why, honestly, that's why she's so popular, because she only knows what she knows and she acts based on that. Whereas Justice Ginsburg is much more consumed with the, I don't want to say theoretical, but conceptual, larger themes, how people, are affected on a grander scale. And it's just interesting thinking about the divisions of their fan bases, because RBG has, essentially become a meme with a certain group of people, like many college-educated urban women between the ages of, let's say, 16 to 40. And Judge Judy is really popular with, like, everybody else, like, she's really popular in urban areas. She's really popular in rural areas. She's really popular with older people. Black women watch Judge Judy at, like, insane rates, which was the most surprising thing for me to learn. So obviously they both have their pros and cons, but it's been interesting to think about how they compare and contrast with each other.
Yeah. Well, here's a snippet of how Judge Judy handles someone before her.
Why would I carve my initials in something? This
because
is the first time I'm hearing about this.
Why? Because you're a moron. That's the reason.
Because
you're a dishonest moron. Because what do you have to lose? Because that would make you a moron.
How about initials?
That would make you a moron.
Yes, ma'am.
Well, yeah, there's not much room for dissent. Does she ever change her mind? Does she ever say, you know what? You're right. I'm wrong.
No, never. I asked her, considering, again, she spent a lot of time in New York family court, and then she spent 2 decades on her TV show. And so I asked her if she'd ever regretted a case, and she could only cite one. When she was in family court, there was a custody case, and she reunited a child with their biological mother who was unwell, mentally unfit, and then the child and the mother disappeared, and the foster family was really upset. And so that was the only thing that she really expressed any regret about. Everything else, she stands by completely.
Where did she come by this certitude in a world that is full of complication and shades of gray? Where did she get this?
I mean, I kind of think it's a coping mechanism. Again, in family court, she was dealing with lots of molested children, lots of abused children, lots of beaten children, lots of starved children. And she was also, at one point, I think, the fastest judge in the court system, which meant that she saw dozens and dozens of cases every day, week, or month. And so in order to sort of deal with the barrage of misery that was coming at her, I think that she really had to organize her world in a very particular way. You look at what's in front of you, you listen to both sides, and then you move on. Because if you start to get lost in the weeds of people's emotions or their backgrounds or what about this, we didn't talk about that, then you can never get anything done.
And yet, as you describe it, she herself was shaped by external events, and they shaped who she is today. Does she ever think of that? To think of, like, well, these people come with a history behind them that might explain something that would perhaps merit some compassion.
I thought about that a lot during our time together. And we did talk a little bit about it. What I will say is that she, in another interview that she had done years and years and years ago, she says essentially that she doesn't accept people's excuses for a person's behavior insofar as, this person came from this type of home or this type of community or this type of family, because undoubtedly there are dozens, hundreds, thousands of people who came from very similar backgrounds and still can be an upstanding citizen who contributes to society. So she maintains that, of course, you can have sad circumstances in your life, but so do many other people, and they have their stuff together, so why don't you?
And I guess it's a message that really resonates. People like that. They like to hear that. In this complicated world, it's nice to have some clarity.
It is nice to have a very black and white view of the world, especially when it's packaged in 30 or 45 minutes on your television screen. It allows for a lot of relief and organization, and you know what's up and what's down.
Jasmine Hughes, associate editor for the New York Times Magazine, and you can read her profile there. It's called Judge Judy is Still Judging You. Jasmine, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And that's it for Press Play. But before we go, we are counting down to the end of the month here at KCRW with a Summer Solstice Challenge grant. You can give now to double your support of KCRW. Summer's here. We're celebrating with a $35,000 challenge grant. Your donation will be matched courtesy of our board members, Julia Wang and Akio Tagawa. Now is a great time to support KCRW. You've seen us around town. Thanks to our local sponsors who believe in our cultural programming and series like Summer Nights. You can be a partner too. Join KCRW. Renew, make an additional gift by Sunday, June 30th to help us reach this at kcrw.com/join. And I'll see you tomorrow.